Jehovah, pilgrims through this barren land, I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hand. Bread of heaven, bread of heaven, feed me till I want no more. The title of the message this morning is The Pilgrim Who Runs. The Pilgrim Who Runs. In 2008, my church leader in Germany approached me and he asked me if I would be interested in serving a year in Canada. So our church in Germany was a Russian Mennonite church, and so was the church in Leamington, Ontario, Canada. The church in Leamington, they predominantly spoke Low German, but their Bible reading was in High German. So the older generation, they understood the High German, but that wasn't the case for the younger ones. So in order to help the young people, the church leadership decided it would be best to offer High German classes in their school. So based on some previous friendships between our two churches, the Leamington School Board, they reached out to us, to our church in Germany, and inquired if somebody would be willing to volunteer to come and teach High German at their school. And so after receiving the request, our church leader approached me and asked if I'm willing to do that. And so I took some time and prayed, and I decided to go. After I arrived in Canada, I felt somewhat overwhelmed. I faced the challenges of another language, another culture, another climate, another currency. Everything was so different. I just didn't feel at home. And I also knew I would only stay for the school year and then afterwards leave again. Here I was, a resident alien, a stranger, or a pilgrim in the big country of Canada. And if some of you visited, or if you lived in a different country, you probably can relate to the challenges I just described of being a stranger in another country. In our song book, Hymns of the Church, we have a section, I think it's around the 700s, it's called The Pilgrimage and Guidance. There you have songs there like, O Father, lead us, guide me, O the great Jehovah, take thou my hand, O Father, marching to Zion. And these songs, they all testify of our life being a journey. This earthly life is merely a transition. We are looking forward to being with God in eternity. This morning I will be using two different pictures to describe our Christian journey. The first one, you probably already guessed, is a pilgrim. The second one we'll talk about later. Let's read Hebrews 11 together. Hebrews 11, and I'm going to read four verses here. Let's read verses 8 through 10 and verse 13. Hebrews 11, starting at verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. As you all know, Hebrews 11 here is called the faith chapter, and it lists characters like Noah, Abram, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Samson, David, Samuel, and others. Hebrews 12, then in verse 1, refers to them as a cloud of witnesses. All of them, if you read through this chapter 11, all of them have an impressive resume, but there's only two characters in Hebrews 11 that the writer dedicates multiple verses to. Most of the other ones just have one or two verses, but Moses and Abraham, they have multiple verses that they are talked about here. Now I will focus on Abraham at this point. Verse 9 of verse 13 that we read that brings out the idea of Abraham being a man of faith, and he especially, but not only being a man of faith, but also being a sojourner, a stranger, and a pilgrim. So what is a pilgrim or stranger? I'm just going to have a brief definition from the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. A pilgrim is one who journeys in foreign lands and is only passing through. And a stranger is a foreigner or a resident alien, not a citizen. Abraham was here, the prime example of a pilgrim. So the question that I had to myself is, what are the characteristics of a pilgrim? It's nice to read about Abraham. It's nice to think about him. It's nice to follow his journey. But what made Abraham such a great character in the Bible, and why does he take up so much space here in Hebrews 11? Number one, a pilgrim has a purpose. I think Abraham did not just wake up one morning and contemplated to leave his homeland, to leave Ur in Chaldea. He didn't just wake up and wonder what type of adventures he could get himself into. He didn't just wake up and pondered how he could make his life more difficult by becoming a nomad. I think he had a clear calling from God. In Genesis, when you go back and read about him, it says, God said to Abraham, "Get thee out of thy country unto a land I will show thee. I will make thee a great nation." I think God's purpose for Abraham was to become a great nation. So Abraham, the pilgrim, had a purpose. Number two, a pilgrim embraces separation. Story in Genesis, he had the initial separation from his homeland. So Abraham departed, and if you want to follow, it's in Genesis 12, verse 4. So Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abraham was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abraham took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and to the land of Canaan they came. It seems like it's easy to read these verses for us in our days. We read these verses, and I really think we don't understand the gravity, what happened here to Abraham. To Abraham, this was not just a slight change in lifestyle or a minute change in his life overall, but it was a complete turning point of his life. He went from being having a steady, scheduled life with his local family to being a nomad with no specific physical destination. He had to leave his friends, some of his family, opportunities, familiarity behind, and he faced the great unknown. I think a pilgrim also embraces separation from others. In Genesis 13, of course, this is a very familiar passage. We read about Abraham and Lot. And Abraham said unto Lot, "Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee." And they separated themselves one from another. Abraham knew in the long run, for practical purposes in this case, he and Lot needed to separate. Also, Abraham keeps himself separated. Abraham moves to Egypt, and you can follow that in the Genesis 13 and 14. He moves to Egypt because of the famine. And he doesn't become part of the Egyptian empire. I mean, you would think if he's there, if things are good, why does he not just stay there and maybe become part of the whole outfit there? Well, he doesn't do that. Abraham also doesn't become part of Sodom and Gomorrah. And even though Abraham rubbed shoulders with Abimelech, the king of Gerar, he didn't become part of that kingdom either. So he had multiple encounters in different places, but he kept himself separated. So a pilgrim embraces separation. Number three, a pilgrim has no permanent home. Well, by definition, a pilgrim is someone who journeys in foreign lands. Well, if you read about Abraham, you can definitely tell that is the case for Abraham. Just a few examples from Genesis. And Abraham passed through the land unto the place of Shechem. Abraham journeyed, going on still toward the south. And Pharaoh sent him away. And he went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel. So there's lots of verses that you can find in Genesis that talk about Abraham moving around, traveling around. He really didn't have a permanent home. And I could give more verses, but I think you get the idea. He did not have a permanent home. He was a nomad. He was moving around and traveling, but he did not have a home. Number four, a pilgrim has a vision. The city Abraham desired was way better than the eloquent buildings of Egypt or Sodom and Gomorrah with its fertile grounds or King Abimelech's kingdom. This is what we read in Hebrews 11. If you go back to Hebrews, verse 10 and 16. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. But now they desire a better country that is a heavenly. So Abraham understood he was a pilgrim and a stranger in the country of the land of promise. But he also understood that his citizenship was somewhere else. He didn't desire an earthly citizenship. That I don't think that was his concern, because if so, he probably would have stayed in Ur of Chaldea. His focus was on something else. He desired a heavenly citizenship. So now let's shift focus and let's direct our attention to one of Abram's travel companions, to Lot. I will take the aforementioned characteristics about a pilgrim and fill Lot in instead of Abraham. So did Lot have a purpose? Well, looking at the beginning of the story in Genesis, I don't see any particular indication of Lot having a calling from God like Abraham had. It only says that Abram departed and Lot went with him. That's in Genesis 12. Now, it's hard to say, of course. I mean, you can basically just speculate. Why did Lot come along? Was it because he looked for some excitement or some adventures? Did he hear about God's calling for Abraham and concluded that that was a good purpose, so I should just go along? Or was he just maybe fed up with the idol worship of his ancestors? I don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. And it might be difficult to come to a good conclusion here. But we don't really read anything specifically about Lot's calling. So how about Lot embracing separation, like Abraham did? Did Lot embrace separation? We can safely deduct that Lot embraced the initial separation from Ur and Chaldea, just like Abraham did. Otherwise, he probably wouldn't have moved along with Abraham. He also agreed to separate from Abraham, even though this really didn't work in his favor, kind of in a spiritual sense. But how about keeping himself separate from others? Well, if you go into Genesis 13, we know that he chose to dwell in the cities of the plain, which was the area where Sodom and Gomorrah was. And then if you read a little further, he pitched his tent towards Sodom. Here at this point, you can say that Lot is at least considering permanent residency in Sodom and Gomorrah. How about the next point? Did Lot abstain from acquiring a permanent home? Well, in Genesis 14, it says he dwelt in Sodom. Later, it says that he sat in the gate of Sodom in Genesis 19, meaning he had some sort of an official position in the city council. And also, when the two angels came to warn him about the destruction of the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, so the cities, they entered into his house. So we know that he had actually a house in the city of Sodom. So it appears that at this point, he can be considered a full-fledged citizen, not just a permanent resident. Number four, did Lot have a vision? Well, after his citizenship of Sodom and Gomorrah was revoked by God, he actually inquires about living in another city, in the city of Zoar. And the Bible doesn't mention anything about Lot reconsidering his actions or his past. So overall, it appears that he didn't have the same long-term vision as Abraham had. So Lot started off as a sojourner and a stranger, but he became acquainted with the land and the people around him. Eventually, he became one of them, so he wasn't a stranger anymore, he was a citizen. Why do I go through Abraham and Lot and talk about this story? I think the question that needs to come to our mind, or came to me at least, is, well, how about you and me? How does this apply to you and me? I can ask the same questions. How do you have a purpose? Do you have a calling from God followed by obedience, just the same as Abraham had? What is your calling? What is your calling as a father? What's your calling as a mother? What's your calling as a single? Well, we do have specific verses in the Bible. One is, but ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and a holy nation, a peculiar people. How about the second point? Do you have, or do you embrace separation? Do you embrace separation from this world? Or is it maybe more a drag for you to not participate in the pleasures of this world? Wherefore, come out from among them and be ye separate, says the Lord. Number three, do you have a permanent home here on earth? I'm not necessarily talking about the physical home. I think we probably all live in a house, some sort of a home. I'm talking about a spiritual home. Do you prefer non-Christian fellowship over the fellowship with believers? Or do you embrace values from this world instead of biblical values? It says in Peter, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts. Number four, do you have a spiritual vision? Do you have a vision for yourself? Well, I had to ask myself that question. Do you have a vision for my life? It's not easy because I tend not to think about that very much, honestly, unless I have to sit down and prepare a message like this. Do you have a vision for your family? Do you have a vision for a godly family? Those are all questions we should ask each other and ourselves. Or do you just go along for the ride? Do you make deliberate effort to teach your children about God's word? Or do you really believe that the children's lesson on Sunday is enough for your children? I mentioned earlier I'm using two different pictures to describe our Christian life. The first one, as you already heard, being a pilgrim. The second one being a runner. Let's go back to Hebrews, and at this point I'm going to read two verses from Hebrews 12, actually. Hebrews 12. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. I chose these two pictures, a pilgrim and a runner, because they both describe life's journey very well. The reference here in the verse 1 to the cloud of witnesses, which include Abraham and the other men of faith in Hebrews 11, illustrate the concept of a stranger and pilgrim. It says in Hebrews 11, they confessed they were strangers and pilgrims on earth. The race analogy, which is in verse 1 as well, 1b, rounds up the image of our life's journey. But before I move on to discuss these verses, I would like to share a story. The story is taken from a book. It's called Finishing Strong, and the author is Steve Farrar. Well, this story is about a man called John Coulter. And is anyone familiar with that name? John Coulter? I wasn't, but maybe some are. Okay, no, nobody. If not, well, maybe in a few minutes you will be familiar with this gentleman. The title of the story is 156 Miles to Bighorn. Only two men failed to return from the storied Lewis and Clark expedition in the early 1800s. One man failed to return because he got sick and died. The other man failed to return because he was smitten. He had just seen the length and breadth of what would one day become the United States of America, from the Great Plains to the Rockies to the Columbia Basin of Oregon to the Pacific Ocean. His young eyes drank in what no white man had ever seen, and the vast wonders of an unexplored continent had a grip on his soul. So when Lewis and Clark set out for home, John Coulter waved them goodbye. He stayed on to explore the wide lands that were outside the scope of the expedition. He wanted to follow some of those trails and paddled some of the rivers he had passed by on the way to the Pacific. He was haunted by their wild beauty. Coulter trapped beaver in the virgin streams of the high country. He was the first white man to witness the geysers of Yellowstone. The young man's love affair with uncharted lands kept him in constant danger. Close encounters with monster grizzlies, churning white water rapids, and always dangerous Indians tested his courage. As years went by, he gained a legendary status among his fellow trappers and mountain men, men not easily impressed. But the accomplishment that sealed Coulter's reputation as a living legend wasn't a battle with a grizzly, shooting rapids in a fragile canoe, or scaling the unknown mountain range. John Coulter was best known for a single foot race. It was a race that would be told and retold around campfires from Columbia to the Missouri. John Coulter had run like no man in history had ever run before. It may have been because he was running for his life. Coulter had been trapping a particular stream with John Potts, an old friend from the Lewis and Clark expedition, as they were canoeing down a stretch of river not far from what today is Bozeman, Montana. They heard some rustling in the brush on both sides of the riverbank. In the next instant, they were surrounded by Blackfeet Indians with drawn bows. There was no time for escape downstream. Coulter did the only thing he could have done. He headed for the riverbank. As they were getting out of the canoe, a huge Indian ran forward and snatched Pot's rifle out of his hand. Potts had enough and jumped into the canoe to escape. No, shouted Coulter, knowing that there was no escape in that direction. The next second, arrows rained down into the canoe, killing Potts. Coulter himself stood on the bank, unarmed and alone. The Blackfeet swarmed around him, stripped him, and tied him down as they held a powwow trying to determine what they should do with him. Then one of the Blackfeet came up with a creative idea. The chief approached Coulter and asked him if he could run like a deer. Coulter indicated that he was not as fast as a deer, but rather as slow as a turtle. That was a lie, for Coulter was a remarkable fast runner. The chief, however, took the bait with a grin and quickly led everyone to a nearby sandy plain. He made a mark, and his warriors towed the line. He then took Coulter and gave him a 300-yard head start. Coulter took off like a shot. Each warrior carried his favorite weapon and yearned for the honor of finishing off the white trapper. The plain stretched ahead of Coulter for 6 miles, dotted only by sagebrush and prickly pear. But shimmering on the horizon, Coulter could see a line of trees on what must have been a bend of a river. He focused on those trees and began to run for his life. Coulter's bare feet were soon cut to bloody ribbons by the sharp stones and prickly pears, but in this race, there was no stopping. 1 mile sped by, 2 miles. At approximately 3 miles, Coulter looked back over his shoulder, for he could no longer hear the yelling of his pursuers or the slap of their moccasins in the dust. Only a handful were still in the hunt, and they were a good distance away. One solitary brave, however, had closed to within 200 yards. Coulter's body was so stressed from the exertion of the chase that blood trickled from his nose. Summoning every ounce of strength he had left, Colter ran the remaining mile to the river and the stand of timber. Out in the middle of the stream, there was a sandbar, and at the head of this little island was a large raft of driftwood, which he had come down in with the spring floods. Colter swam out to the raft, dove underneath it, and came up where several of the entangled logs formed a roof above his head. Here he waited for the pursuing Blackfeet up to his neck in the icy cold water under the makeshift shelter. He soon heard the Blackfeet, who swarmed around the river onto the sandbar and even stood up on the logs that covered Colton's head, but they couldn't find him. The terrible day, however, was still young, so the Blackfeet kept up the hunt until late afternoon before finally withdrawing. Under cover of darkness, John Colter swam downstream until he found a tiny stretch of bank concealed by trees and brush. Half frozen and nearly delirious from exposure and loss of blood, Colter pulled himself out of the stream and lay gasping on the bank. He had no rifle, no food, no fire, no horse, no shoes, no clothing. He had been stripped of everything, everything but his will to live. John Colter was half dead and 150 miles away from the trading post at Bighorn. Yet 7 days later, he walked bleeding and hungry into the Bighorn compound. In that moment, he became a living legend. Stripped of everything and against the worst odds imaginable, John Colter outran and outsmarted the pursuing Blackfeet for 156 miles. In spite of everything, he managed to finish strong. That's quite a story, isn't it? Well, I have to tell you this. When we study Scripture, we find out that the Christian life is more than a 156-mile run. It's a marathon that lasts the entire life. So coming back to verse 1 and 2 in Hebrews 12, the writer here in the second half of the verse describes the Christian life in terms of a race. It says, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith." So how do you run a spiritual race? Number one, lay aside the weight and sin. This is what it says here. Lay aside the weight and sin. Now picture with me a runner that wears a helmet, that's a winter coat, long pants, boots, heavy boots, and maybe even a backpack with some sort of equipment in case of an emergency. And just think about that picture. A marathon runner would never do that. We know that. He would not reach the finish line with all that extra weight. Well, if you watch a marathon runner, you know that they're wearing the bare minimum. They're wearing maybe a t-shirt, a pair of shorts, some socks, very, very light running shoes. And maybe they wear a hydration backpack so there's water in there so they could drink over those, I don't know, 40 miles or how many miles they run. So here, the Hebrew writer encourages us to put aside the extra weight so that we can run the race successfully. But unfortunately, all too often, we as Christians try to run the race with all the heavy gear on, seems like it. To complete the marathon of life, we need to put away the weight and sin. Carrying around heavy baggage is not an option. In order to be successful and complete the race, we need to leave the weight behind. I don't know what your weight is. You can fill in the blank. Is it guilt? Is it fear? Is it anger? Loneliness? Bitterness? Unbelief? Lust? There's so many things you could fill in the blank. Let me share a story with you. A young man had a significant ministry in this small English village many years ago. People were coming from miles around to hear him teach the scriptures. In the mid-20s, he had a ferocious appetite for not only teaching the scriptures, but knowing them as well. He was making an impact in the village and the surrounding area until the charges were made. A young woman came forward and claimed that he had tried to force himself upon her. The word spread like a wildfire across the countryside. He was finished. The sentiments of the people were with the young girl, and his reputation was in shambles. It was all a lie. It simply never happened. The young man, however, struggled deeply with the betrayal of the young woman whom he had legitimately tried to help. But she had turned on him and was in the process of ruining his ministry for life. He thought he would never recover. How could he ever minister again anywhere with such charges against him? Bitterness just about overwhelmed him. The betrayal was too much. He couldn't bear it and he couldn't undo it. But with God's help, he refused to allow the bitterness to take root in his heart. God enabled him to conquer the bitterness just as Joseph had conquered it. The falsely accused young man thought that he would never again be used by God. But there are millions of people who can now vouch for the fact that Oswald Chambers was greatly used by God before it was all over. To this day, his book, My Utmost for His Highest, tops the Christian bestsellers. Now, in the story, we see how Oswald Chambers laid aside the weight of bitterness so he could continue in his Christian race. And regardless what our weight or our sin is that we carry around, let's put it to the cross. Let's put it to rest at the cross. How else do you run a spiritual race? Well, run it with perseverance. Number two. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Patience or perseverance is used in the translations, NIV or King James Version. Run with perseverance. Well, years ago, believe it or not, I ran multiple races. I should almost say decades ago by now, but I ran a couple races. I ran a 10K, which is about 6.5 miles. And I ran also some 5Ks, 5 kilometers, which is about 3 miles. And every time I ran a race, I observed the same pattern. So the majority of the runners start off with a sprint almost. You know, once the race starts, a lot of them start off with a sprint. After a few minutes, you could see how the excitement wears down and the energy levels are somewhat depleted. And the runners that were initially in the front, they started to fall back in the group. In contrast, runners who didn't start off super strong gained ground and eventually start to lead the group. I think the key word here is perseverance or patience, as we read in the King James Version. The challenge is not so much the beginning of the race as is the end. And the same is true for our spiritual life. It's wonderful that we entered in the spiritual race, but now the challenge is actually to stay in the race. Let me share a poem with you. It's called The Race. It's also taken from the book Finishing Strong by Steve Farrar. The Race. Defeat. We lay there silently, a tear dropped from his eye. Or he lay there silently, a tear dropped from his eye. There is no sense running anymore. 3 strikes, I'm out. Why try? The will to rise had disappeared. All hope had fled away. So far behind, so arrow prone, closer all the way. I've lost. So what's the use, he thought. I live with my disgrace. But when he thought about his dead, who soon had to face. Get up, an echo sounded low. Get up and take your place. You were not meant for failure here. So get up and win the race. With borrowed will, get up, it said. You haven't lost at all, for winning is not more than this, to rise each time you fall. So up he rose to win once more, and with a new commitment, he resolved that win or lose, at least he couldn't quit. So far behind the others now, the most he'd ever been. Still, he gave it all he had and ran as though to win. Three times he had fallen stumbling, three times he rose again. Too far behind to hope to win, he still ran to the end. They cheered the winning runner as he crossed first place, head high and proud and happy, no falling, no disgrace. But when the fallen youngster crossed the line, last place, the crowd gave him the greater cheer for finishing the race. And even though he came in last, with head bowed low and proud, you would have thought he won the race to listening to the crowd. And to his dad, he sadly said, "I didn't do so well." "To me, you won," his father said. "You rose each time you fell." And now when things seem dark and hard and difficult to face, the memory of that little boy helps me in my race. For all of life is like that race, with ups and downs and all. And all you have to do to win is rise each time you fall. Quit, give up, you're beaten. They still shout in my face, but another voice in me says, get up and win the race. I hope you got the point. The point is not to give up, to get up and to keep running the race, no matter how often we fall. And I think this poem brings it out very well. So, how do we run a spiritual race? Run with patience, run with perseverance. Number three, fixing our eyes on Jesus. Let's go back to Hebrews 12. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Verse 2. The NIV translates this phrase or this part of the verse as fixing our eyes on Jesus. I really like that phrase. In fact, if you haven't noticed, it's printed actually on the hymns of the church on the spine, on the cover spine. Fixing your eyes on something. I see that every day at work. When the surgeon gets ready to make an incision, he's completely focused on his task. He knows where to cut, how deep to cut. His full attention and focus are needed to make this surgery successful. There is no distraction, no looking away, just looking at the surgical site. And our spiritual life demands the same attention. There shouldn't be any distraction, no looking away, just looking at Jesus. If you want to run the race successfully, we need to put our undivided attention on Jesus. Our focus needs to be solely on him. Anything else, any distraction, will make us waver. Well, shouldn't we put our eyes? Well, we should not put our eyes on the world, or on the values of this world, or on money, or on idols. These days, it seems like when I'm at work, there's a lot of talk about this athlete or that athlete or this singer or that song. And I don't think this is what Jesus is calling us to. He calls us to fix our eyes on him. We shouldn't put our eyes on politicians either or some sort of ministries. Humans are humans and will disappoint us sooner or later. But Jesus is the only one who won't disappoint us. That's why we need to fix our eyes on him. I would like to close with a little story. Many years ago, a man hired an experienced guide to lead him through the Swiss Alps. Anybody here went to the Swiss Alps before? Okay, there's a couple of people. It's a pretty high mountain range, and especially if you go for a hike, you better know where you're going and what path to take, otherwise you might not come back. After many hours, they came to a high and remote mountain pass. To the man's dismay, he saw that the path had almost been washed out. What could he do? To the left was a sheer rock cliff. To his right, a precipice drop that nearly was 1,000 feet deep. Looking down, the man felt his head growing faint and his knees beginning to buckle. At that moment, his guide shouted, "Do not look down, or you are a dead man. Keep your eyes on me, and where I put my feet, put yours there as well." The man did as he was instructed, and soon he passed from danger to safety. So fixing our eyes on Jesus. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, this morning we come before you, and we are grateful for the examples that we have in scriptures of Abraham and how he was faithful in his pilgrimage. And we are also thankful, Father, for the reminder of running the race and not giving up. Help us, O Lord, in our lives. Help us to be humble and help us to get up when we fail, when we fall. And help us to finish strong. In Jesus' name, amen.